This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. We'll fulfill all your old-timey bluegrass and folk needs on the show today with musicians Paul Brown and his Piedmont pal and wife, Terry McMurray. They're coming soon to a stage near you, and they'll be picking and grinning with me here just about 15 minutes from now. But first, we're off to High Point via the Bronx. High Point University's beautiful Seacrest Gallery is home to the fascinating new solo exhibition of paintings by abstract expressionist Maria Sultan. Director and curator Maxine Campbell says Maria's works were painted, quote, with unabashed freedom. Sultan incorporates brilliant splashes of rich color, flat planes, and subtle variants of textured grays and elegant childlike lines in her paintings and drawings. Maria says her work reflects the atmosphere and sounds swirling around her. That atmosphere changed dramatically about 4 years ago with a move from her home in New York to High Point, North Carolina. With many of the visual artists I've spoken with, this inner yearning or making art starts at a young age. When were you first aware of this tendency and how did it begin?
Well, you know, I grew up in New York in the Bronx in a tenement. And you know what happens in poverty situations? There's so much happening. And my brother, who was a prodigy musician, so here we have a soon-to-be visual artist and you have a prodigy musician all in the same household in a blue-collar family in poverty, and they didn't know what to do with us. For me, I would put my art supplies underneath my bed in case it was an emergency, which was, you know, unusual. No one knew it was my secret. So, you know, in this tenement, there was cracks in the ceiling. There were tiles that were broken. And what they would do, because I don't know why, they would just paint over. They wouldn't spackle or re-sheet rock or do that. They would paint over and over and over and over. So then there was these monochromatic, amazing cracks that became my first contemporary art museum, to be honest with you. So it was in me from the beginning.
That's such a great way of looking at that, is the cracks as being really on exhibit in your own room.
When a child looks up at the sky and they look at clouds and they see images, it was my structures, you know, I would repeat the patterns. I wonder now why in my abstraction, why those particular shapes don't show up, because I remember them explicitly. They don't show up, but I do know that it had an imprint in that writing on the wall, that what's painted on the wall is important. And it was important to me because I would stare at it endlessly. So it isn't a surprise that now in my work, I want to have the quality sometimes of a wall. Sometimes I'll scrub and scrub and add sand and add mica and add just until I get a feeling of a cracked wall.
You mentioned mica, and that's another one of the elements from your early childhood that does find its way repeatedly into some of your work. That sparkle.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. When anyone sees an art, anything that sparkles, they question. They think, is this decoration? And for me, it's not. So here I am in this tenement that was very unattractive, for, you know, you can imagine. In the back of this tenement, they had the great good sense to put mica into the concrete. So when I'd go in this backyard that was overgrown and there was, you know, refuse back there and everything, you know, you can imagine. There was a long pathway of concrete that had mica that would sparkle in the sun. And that is what I remember as like the place of sparkle, the place that became heaven on earth for me.
From New York to High Point, quite a shift, and quite a shift in how it impacts your art.
My particular way of working is to paint the atmospheric condition. My ex-husband, he was doing a project in North Carolina, and he was working with musicians down here, and I had never considered North Carolina, but one day he came home and he said, oh, we're gonna move there for a while. And this was about 4 years ago. And what happened here is that the atmosphere in this particular state is remarkable. We lived in the Pine Ridge Mountains and now in High Point. There is an open window. I can't explain it. But the work that I've done in North Carolina has more space. It has a peace level. There's something that goes on in this state that's not, I mean, I've traveled all over the world and I've traveled all over this country. I've been in almost every state in the union. But there's something that's happened here in North Carolina. There's a sweetness here. And looking at the history, I'm not surprised that Many very well-known abstractionists have come here. Franz Klein was here. Rauschenberg was here. De Kooning was here. John Cage was doing projects with them. So the spontaneous avant-garde music with these painters who were painting, you know, this atmospheric condition, their internal atmospheric condition, and breaking form. In addition, what's happened is that there is a group of musicians that I have collaborated with and aligned myself with. So I have painted while they have played. So many of the pieces that are in this gallery, that are in this show, are pieces that I have done while they were performing.
I want to plumb that with you a little bit, because I know music is a huge part of what you do and how you respond to it as you're working. What role does the music itself play in your work?
I believe that the form of the work that I do would be likened to jazz. It's the same kind of a language in a visual form. I, lived with a musician for 23 years, so it's been part of my internal makeup to consider music as a through line. I remember for years we wouldn't even have the television on because it was too much of an interruption of sound.
When you make a comparison to jazz, I think improvisation. I know it's all rooted in fundamentals, but what's going on as you're creating?
When it's working, you're in yourself and you're outside of yourself. I always feel that there's this remote will. When it's really working, there is something else that's working through you. And I have to relate back to Kandinsky, because he understood there was a connection between music, the visual arts, and the spiritual. I do agree with him that these three things collide. I'm very focused on it in my own work. And when it's actually happening and life is being put on the canvas, it's because this other thing is going on. Basquiat said that, in relationship to spirituality and art, I mean, think about Basquiat. He was with Warhol. He had serious drug problems. Just so much was going on for him. And the work, certainly in the pop movement, this was profound, his work. It was filled with life and filled with complexity and filled with political and artistic statement. But he said that without God, it's like having no water. So he understood it, too.
You're taking on, obviously, these larger issues of life and why we're here in existence, and some of the things you just referenced are going on in your mind as you're creating. They're taking on large canvases and murals, and I'm wondering what drew you to that particular way of displaying your work.
I totally believe that artists are required to put back beauty into this world. That, in fact, we are required to, some artists have to bring beauty in by just telling a social commentary and making a statement so that we can shift the way we see. Other artists have to put something that has such an aesthetic value that it's going to shift the people who are looking at it. I mean, so you can work 8 inches and you can touch a heart, and you can work 7 feet or 10 feet and touch a heart. And so my obligation, whether it is a large format or a smaller format, is to put life out there and to, in fact, touch who's watching it. Because in the interaction, the reason why I love abstraction so much is that when a person, the viewer becomes part of the work. So the viewer's reception of the work and how they respond to the work and what they see in the work and how they, people come up to me and they say, oh, I saw, I don't know. Some people say they're urban landscapes. The anatomy certainly shows up in my paintings, and that I leave, even though I try to pull back from representational forms, the female form comes up. And sometimes disconnected body parts, like, well, why is, just her upper torso or the lower part of the torso, why is that? Why are they not connected? And why? Well, it's partly because of its abstraction, but also because of what women have gone through in their lives and what I have weathered and been seasoned and what I've gone through. So if I'm disconnected, and I put it on the canvas, and I put it in this format of saying that ultimately life is worth it. And ultimately, there is color and flavor and passion, and there's a point to our existence. And then when the color is exaggerated and full, my inner life is saying, the inside of me, this remote thing that I paint with, you know, which is my concept of spirituality and the connection with God and with whatever created all things, however we want to deem that, it gets put on the work.
Well, you referenced abstraction there a couple of times, and you've been influenced by the New York School of Abstract Expressionists. Could you describe for listeners the sort of the textures and use of color that we're going to find at the Seacrest Gallery in some of your work?
When you go to art schools, they tell you, well, you must keep your palette limited and, you know, make these beautiful palette arrangements. Pick these five colors and work that. And I refuse that. I've had so many instructors in my history. I was trained at the Art Students League in the Woodstock School of Art, and I was in a program that was in conjunction with the San Francisco Art Institute in California, and I reject that. I am so enamored by color, and I am not afraid to put many colors in the work, and the harmony becomes in the extreme of the colors. So it becomes a composition. So they're all, it's like writing a piece of music. You keep adding tracks, and you keep adding layers, and I keep adding these layers, and then and then removing them with emulsions. I remove it with these harsh chemicals, brush cleaners, and then I shellac, and then I take it off, and then sometimes I power wash to burn it, to take it all off and start again, because the other thing is I want the colors pure. I will tell you that when I am in the dingiest places, sometimes I've been in these hotels in New York, there's something, and I'm traveling back and forth and I'll wind up in these places that I will work in these dingy spots, and I will do the most profoundly joyful pieces in these unlikely spots. And then I come to North Carolina and I'm working with shades of gray, which I love. The other thing that I'm passionate about is the variance of gray. I don't think the world is really black and white. I think it's in shades of gray. And sometimes you're a little bit closer to the light and sometimes you're a little closer to the dark. And certainly the pieces here have been a celebration of the shades of gray.
I want to talk about some of the other recurring images in your work too, because ladders reminds me of the use of keyboard shapes often.
Oh, keyboards show up all the time.
And they were
conga drums, African percussion instruments show up.
The vessels.
You see the vessels. It's because I'm so connected to them. Sometimes sheet music, sometimes notes show up. Not that you really see them as a note. I don't go out and visually, let me just paint notes. It will show up because it's all about the music and it's all about the cross connection. I love to work with musicians. Let me tell you why I love to work with musicians. It's really important. And this is something that I would love to impart to all young artists everywhere, that the day has to come where we collaborate and stop attacking everything that's not our particular flavor of work. When musicians are seasoned and they work together, they are happy about it. They get excited and it pushes the work. It makes the work better. What was remarkable about the New York School is that these 10 individual painters were moving together. They were pushing each other and the work became remarkable. What was happening in Paris in the salons during Impressionism is that they were pushing each other. Our group of individualized artists now have to stop attacking each other and start working in collaboration so that the work can get better. And so I work with musicians specifically because their spirit is, when you're working together, you're going to push the envelope together.
Visual artist Maria Sultan. Her exhibition of large-scale paintings from 2012 to 2015, titled Elemental Emulsions, will continue at High Point University's Seacrest Gallery through March 5th. On Friday, February 6th, from 4 to 6, there will be a reception at the gallery with an artist talk at 5 and musical performance by violinist Marta Richardson. It's free and open to the public, and you'll find links to more information as well as images of Maria's paintings at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, it's time for a short break. Traditional Appalachian music multi-instrumentalists Paul Brown and Terry McMurray will share what makes this music so great and why, if you like what you hear, you're in the right place. So stick around. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. More great music on the way in just a minute, and then we'll be throwing in a little scholarly film study with Butter Birkus that'll restore your faith in the Flickies. Later on in the second half of the show, the Unbroken Circle, Wake Forest's multi-generational string band, is keeping that great Piedmont tradition alive while raising funds for the Shalom Project. The variety and richness of music traditions found throughout the Piedmont and Blue Ridge is just staggering. Paul Brown is a former NPR newscaster, WFDD news director, and a celebrated musician. Terry McMurray, Paul's wife, is a talented multi-instrumentalist and retired educator. They both share a deep and abiding love for traditional Appalachian music, and for decades they've shined a light on the amazing musicians who have kept the tradition alive, their music, and the wonderful stories that go along with it. This weekend, in collaboration with the Blue Ridge Music Center and their great interpretive mission, Paul, Terry, and Piedmont pal Craig Smith return to Winston-Salem with Across the Blue Ridge, Old Sounds, New Trails. Together, they'll perform as the House Band, and that's one heck of a house band, by the way, and they'll be joined by guest performers, the dynamic Buck Stenkel Boys, Helen White, and legendary guitarist and luthier Wayne Henderson.
I'm going down that long, lonesome road, Lord, I'm down that long, lonesome road.
Do you remember the moment when you fell in love with traditional music?
Goes too far back for me to remember, David. I think my mom was singing when I was in the womb. And it was just part of my existence from the get-go. It was part of my audio landscape when I was a very small child, because mom would sing these songs from Central Virginia that she'd learned as a kid around the house all the time. Songs like Lonesome Road Blues and Going Down to Tampa, Settle Down, Railroad Bill. So I just was very comfortable with those types of melodies, and I loved them. Now, you ask me why? That I can't tell you. Yeah. Glad you didn't ask, because, you know, I had a brother and a sister. They were neither here nor there on it. I had several cousins. They didn't learn any of the songs that Mom and my Aunt Beth played and sang. So it was me.
Hey, watching you guys play together on—I love YouTube for this very reason, because I haven't had a chance to see you all play together, but watching you all play Backstep Cindy together earlier today at the Midwest Banjo Camp's faculty concert back in 2012, it made me wonder what it's like for you two, and I'll throw it both your way, sharing this great tradition together. Terry, I'll throw it your way. What's it like?
Well, it's certainly the reason that we're together. I mean, that we met through coming to the Mount Airy region, pursuing our interests in music. That's how we met. I think that it winds up being a centering part of our lives. Sometimes we forget that, you know, maybe we just need to sit and play some music. Everything will be all right.
That's great. I think about that. My wife is a violinist. I was a clarinetist. And just even going to hear music together, I can't put it into words sometimes, just that special connection, just hearing it and knowing that she appreciates it as I do. What's it like for you, Paul? I mean, not getting beyond playing, but just experiencing the tradition together.
Well, I just find it an incredibly satisfying experience to be one of millions of carriers of this story and this art form, generation by generation. Anytime I play a song, I think of the person I learned it from or who had played it in the old days. And any time that Terry and I are playing together, you know, we typically wind up going through our repertoire that we learned around some of the old masters of North Carolina and Virginia. And Terry, I'm not sure how your thought process goes through this or your awareness, but I know that when I'm playing with you and we're working on an old tune or singing a song, the images of the people we hung out with are just there with me all the time. Those old-timers are just swimming around and just floating through my consciousness as we're playing these songs and tunes. And it's very, very satisfying to me and sort of heartwarming in a way that's almost hard to describe.
I'm smiling and nodding my head.
That's for those of you off in radio land.
Right.
Uh,
of those great figures swirling around future. I'm assuming one of them might be the late, great Tommy Jarrell. And you and I share something in common in that back in the early 80s, I heard my good friend Brad Annis playing banjo with a fiddler, another classmate. I might have been 12. And I was hooked, and I took up music as a result of that. And I wound up going from Wisconsin to Chicago to go study clarinet and pursue music.
I forgot we have a Wisconsin connection.
We've got the Wisconsin connection. Yeah. And I was from La Crosse to Chicago. You're from Madison area North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And that's a big commitment and a big move. Take me back to that time and what happened.
Well, I'd made the pilgrimage to Mount Airy, I'm thinking in 81, met Tommy Jarrell and his daughter, and they invited me to come for the summer. I stayed with his daughter, and my work situation was such that I was available to do that. I had been working in research, and the grant funding had ended, and, you know, things like that. Anyway, so I was available to do that. My plan was to come for, probably not 3 months, but maybe 2 months or something in the summer. And I just fell in love with just the whole area, the scene, the community. I was a member of the community. And Tommy's daughter would go to work at the mills every day, and I would go over to Tommy's house just a couple blocks away. Neither of them drove, so I sort of took on the, at least provide transportation to places. And Tommy and I sometimes would visit people. Sometimes we'd play music, and sometimes we'd watch Gunsmoke. And it was wonderful. And, it was just...
You should love to listen to Tommy narrate Gunsmoke.
Yeah, indeed.
He always had an opinion about what was going on.
But I think Paul and I both feel that we chose to become part of a community as opposed to becoming collectors of lots of different kinds of tunes from a lot of different people. Hmm. So we were in a very, very rich community.
But yeah, musically speaking, it's just the whole region that we are sitting in right now is pretty amazing when you compare it to a lot of communities elsewhere in the country.
We were fortunate that there were still many musicians alive and playing at the time that we were there. And I met Paul that summer, and we became really good friends. But musically, it was just wonderful carrying Tommy to visit some of his music friends and, just sort of being there and listening to them reminisce, sometimes play music.
See, the fiddle's called the devil's instrument anyhow, so I've been told. But I never did believe that.
Corn whiskey and pretty women, they've been my downfall.
When I see Tommy Jarrell play again, I'm back to YouTube. When I would hear Doc Watson play, I had this similar feeling of just being taken back to a different place in time. And I'm wondering what it was like learning from this man. What images come back when you just that kind of that student guru thing or whatever happens in a time when you're playing with someone like Tommy Jarrell and learning from him? What stands out?
Well, for me, I would say when we played music, most of the time, we just played tunes from his repertoire. Once or twice, I recall, getting him to show me some things specifically. Paul actually did some slightly more formalized learning. I mean, formalized in that he had gotten a grant. So mainly, it would have just been playing tunes from his repertoire and, me trying to learn how to listen better to what he was doing. Many of our friends who came to visit Tommy have a pretty similar funny story in that, we learned some tune that we were going to, one of his tunes that we were going to play for him so that, he would be very proud that we had learned one of his tunes. And so you'd finish playing this tune and he'd go, "Well, that's a right nice tune. What do you call that one?" And I can't tell you how many people that has happened to.
Happened a bunch of times.
They're just different turns and tunes that, when you're not in a community, sometimes you don't hear that. So I learned to listen to the music a lot differently.
I think one of the great things about traditional music and the fact that it is passed on by ear most often is that whatever your listening and learning style is, will be accommodated by this type of music. So for me, it was looking intently, watching what Tommy was doing with the bow or the left hand fingering, or if he was on the banjo, how was he positioning his left hand and his right hand? Why was he getting that sound and how did he do it? He was also, I'll have to say, one of the most complete musicians I ever encountered. And I would say the same for Doc Watson. Tommy had a full view of what he wanted an instrument to sound like. And typically, since he grew up in an era before guitars and before amplified sound and before large ensembles, large bands, he wanted either the banjo or the fiddle, David, to sound complete. He wanted the melody, he wanted rhythmic accompaniment, he wanted bass as well as treble. And on both instruments, he played so that you would try to keep a treble and a bass string going all the time. It was a rare day that you would hear just a single note out of an instrument that Tommy was playing. He was always alternating back and forth between a higher string and a lower string. What was amazing to me, because I met a lot of traditional musicians over the years, some of whom were more able to talk about what they did than others, was that Tommy was very articulate. He could tell me what it was that he was trying to do and why. And that was a really big thing. So then when he was showing me banjo, I had a National Endowment for the Arts Folk Arts Apprenticeship grant for a year at one point, and I would go to his house every day and we'd play banjo. When he was showing me, he would tell me to, you know, get this string and then go back over and get one of these other ones. Keep that bass going. And I'd watch how he did it with his hand and then try it and try it and try it. He wouldn't necessarily say, this is too slow or this needs to be more staccato or something like that. But one of the funny stories that I remember is that at one point I was trying to get a tune on the fiddle, and it was a tune titled Let Me Fall. And it's played in the key of A. It's got a D chord in it. And when you hit the D chord, the way Tommy played it, it had this sort of scream to it. And I was playing the chord pretty much correctly, as a concert fiddler might play. I never played violin, but I was listening to it, and I thought I had it pretty well. And Tommy was getting slightly more agitated as we went along. And finally, he just got really frustrated. He said, "My gosh, Paul," he said, "take that finger and put it, move it further up there. You've got to it's got to have the whine to it." And what he was telling me, David, was use the old mountain intonation. It wasn't supposed to sound sweet. It was supposed to have that sound of tear to it and slight discordance. And doggone, when I moved that finger up just a little bit, supposedly off key, I had the note that he was looking for. And it was somewhere between, you know, maybe a quarter tone off or an eighth tone off of what somebody would think would be correct. It was between two notes. And learning those sorts of things in that way from such a masterful player was the experience of a lifetime for me. It was just great.
Seems like the thrust of Across the Blue Ridge, Old Sounds, New Trails, this concert tour is bringing it to the people in a way that they can really appreciate. And that's my take on it. But I mean, from your all's vantage, I mean, the purpose of the tour, spell it out for us.
The Blue Ridge Music Center approached me when I retired from NPR and came back home to Winston-Salem and said, "Would you like to produce some programs for us?" And I said, "Well, yeah, if they're interpretive in some manner." And as it turned out, that's exactly what Richard Emmett was looking for at the Blue Ridge Music Center up on the Parkway. He wanted to provide some context to this music for people. Because it's one thing to listen to music and say, "Well, that's nice." Or to go to a performance of old time or bluegrass or traditional music and say, "Well, that was fun." But, you know, the social conditions and the conditions of life have changed over the past number of decades. And for many of us, the music is interesting, but it's not necessarily a part of our background or daily life, or we might not know just where some of these tunes have come from and why they sound the way they do. So the point of this series and the point of my working with the Blue Ridge Music Center is to help people who may not be 100% familiar with this music get a bead on where it's coming from. Why does it sound that way? Why is a banjo and a fiddle such an unusual and wonderful combination? why are these instruments present in the South when maybe some of them are less present in the North? Why do bluegrass harmonies sound the way they do? Why does someone like Tommy Jarrell or one of his proteges play music in all registers, keeping high and low strings going? Why did Benton Flippin play his fiddle with a long, straight bow and all sorts of slides? Why does this music sound the way it does? So we're trying to help people get a sense of not only the beauty of the music, but a sense of ownership and connectedness to it through understanding the historical context, meeting some of the players, hearing them talk as well as play, tell their stories, and just experiencing the music in a more complete, multi-dimensioned way.
WFDD loyal listeners are more than familiar with Across the Blue Ridge, which aired for years in the station and a very loyal following. But after years away and talking about the gap of a decade or two, what's it like being back in the saddle and producing the show first off, and what sorts of responses have you been getting? Because you're now well on, this is step five on this tour.
This is the fourth concert, but I also did a series last summer at the Music Center. So we've got this traveling series this winter.
Yeah.
To just get the music out there and help make people aware of the Blue Ridge Music Center. It's a pretty wonderful feeling. You know, Terry and I play a lot around the country, and we do programs that are in some ways similar to this. But this is a big, focused project, and it's been really fun so far. I've enjoyed it.
The live performance aspect of these things, it takes it into a different realm. You can listen to a great CD, and if you're alone at home in a dark room and really focused, you can have a wonderful listening experience. But seeing it live, and not just the music, but fantastic performers, beginning with Wayne Henderson, who we've been really fortunate enough to have the great guitarist here, along with his buddy Herb, and in this case, it's going to be him and Helen White joining
and
you
all. And Herb Key, all three of them.
And Herb's going to be there. Mm-hmm. Oh, great. Remind listeners what an influential picker he is, and he's also a great storyteller, too.
He's a tremendous storyteller. I think he's got to be one of the funniest people I've ever met. You know, first time he told me that he made a guitar by taking a big piece of wood and cutting out everything that did not look like a guitar, I just thought I'd fall off my chair. I loved it. And Wayne's like that all the time. You know, he's just great. But he is a splendid guitar maker. He is an unassuming guy, which is always great in a performer, and he is a fabulous mountain-style guitar player. He has a tremendous way with melody and tone. It all seems effortless until you try it. You know, he's one of those players. He just sits there, and these full, rich-sounding notes just roll out of the guitar. He learned a lot of his music from the late E.C. Ball, who was a gospel singer and guitar player up on the mountains right near where Wayne lived, and very, very well known in traditional music circles. And so Wayne carries on that heritage. He grew up in the music, he was around one of the best players, and he's just the most sharing person you can imagine.
And as if the great Wayne Henderson isn't enough for one show, you've got the Buxtehude Boys, too, a group so steeped in the tradition.
One of the points of Across the Blue Ridge Old Sounds New Trails tour is, as part of this mission of providing some context to help people understand that the music continues. You know, there's a new generation, and some of them have a whole boatload of energy, and they are taking this music to some wonderful places. What I love about the Buxtehude Boys is they're all from this area, from southwestern Virginia and northwest North Carolina. Most, if not all of them, have pretty deep roots in this music through family and friends. Wes Clifton, the front man, is the grandson of Verlin Clifton, formerly of the Smoky Valley Boys and Camp Creek Boys, and just a very enthusiastic guy. Andy Edmonds mentored, trained with Benton Flippin for years. He really watched Benton play the fiddle up there in Surrey County. And I find that gratifying because I did the same thing with Benton on the banjo and the fiddle 30 years ago and knew him all the way along. And it was wonderful to see someone from an entirely new generation come and seek out this elderly gentleman.
Musicians, historians, educators, and just all-around great folks, Paul Brown and Terry McMurray. Across the Blue Ridge, Old Sounds, New Trails with Craig Smith, Wayne Henderson, Helen White, and the Buxtehude Boys is Saturday, February 7th at 2 p.m. and 7:30 at the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art, SECA, in Winston-Salem. Both shows are sold out, but thankfully for us here in the Piedmont, you don't have to wait long or look far for lots of excellent traditional Appalachian music performances.
The Blue Ridge Music Center at Milepost 210 on the Parkway near Galax has outdoor amphitheater concert programs every Saturday during the warm months and lunchtime performances practically daily in the breezeway there. There's a new Earl Scruggs Museum in Shelby, North Carolina you'll want to check out, dedicated to the life and times of the man who revolutionized banjo picking in the post-war era. Up in Bristol, Virginia, there's a wonderful museum devoted to what it calls the birthplace of country music. There's a Tuesday night contra dance in Clemens with live music, WPAQ in Mount Airy, and the merry-go-round every Saturday live downtown at the Earl Theater. And while in Mount Airy, you might want to check out the Fiddlers Conventions there in the spring and in June. There are Fiddlers Conventions in Freeze, Virginia, West Jefferson, North Carolina, and in Clifftop, West Virginia every summer. You'll find a Fiddler Convention there as well, just to name a few. You'll find complete listings in the Old Time Herald magazine, and you can always stay connected to all the cool arts haps going on in the Piedmont, well, at least lots of them, on our website, WFDD.org, and be sure and click on Triad Arts Weekend, where we'll post links to what's available. I'm David Ford. We'll take a short break once more before returning with Movie Talk. Butter Berkus and the Faith and Film series at Centenary United Methodist Church is coming up next, and Martha Allman's got a string band that spans the generations next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. In addition to providing traditional services and church activities, Centenary United Methodist Church in Winston-Salem has been exploring faith through virtually all of the arts, with poetry readings, painting, sculpture, music, and more. The music and arts ministry there continually pushes the arts envelope forward with weekly Roots Revival performances, special events like this weekend's Love Thy Neighbor fashion show, and once again this year, movies. Centenary's ongoing Faith and Film series is curated and hosted by former River Run Film Festival director Butter Berkus. She gives pre-film lectures and facilitates post-film discussions with audience members to provide deeper insight into each of the classic films presented throughout the season. This year's Faith and Film series theme is The Mythic Hero, a subject that's near and dear to Butter's heart.
When I went back to school in the 90s, and the film school was only, I think I was in the third class, the only book we were required to read when we went to school was Joseph Campbell's The Power of Myth. And basically, that book focused on story and how there are common stories that resonate with all of us, no matter our country or culture. And there is a consistency in these stories that generally are built around a hero, and I mean that in both the male and the female form. These stories, they resonate with us because it is a call to leave one's comfort zone in these stories and to face challenges, to often suffer, but then find a resolution at the close of the story.
It seems like the three films you've selected for this year do a neat job of pairing, moving the story along with character development. And I've never seen City Lights. Confession, made in 1931, romantic comedy by written by and directed by Charlie Chaplin. Taking on alcoholism here and visual impairment, it just strikes me in 2015 as being somewhat progressive or forward-looking. Was it, and what were some other ways in which this guy was pushing the envelope?
Well, Chaplin was a real film auteur. He wanted to be in control of everything. And he started developing this film story-wise in 1928. His mother died in the course of filming, and I think it was very traumatic to him. He was very close to his mother. So, in fact, it's been written that this film is fairly autobiographical. His father was an alcoholic and abusive. And so I think as the film neared its completion, he put more and more of that. It was his own personal journey. I think this is one of Chaplin's, if not his greatest film, certainly one of his greatest films. And the character he meets during the course of the film, who is the millionaire alcoholic, who, while he's drunk, you know, loves the little tramp, but once he sobers up, he wants nothing to do with him. He completely casts him out. So in considering this and the struggles he had with his father, I can imagine that he wanted to tell this part of the story. Chaplin said, "Everything I do is a dance. I think in terms of dance. I think more so in City Lights." So as a little tramp, he was, you know, he walks funny, he moves funny, he's got his cane, he's got the big shoes, he looks like a clown. And yet, at the close of this film, James Agee, who was the film critic for Life magazine in 1954, said that he thought the last scene in this film was the best piece of acting he had ever seen committed to celluloid.
And following that with Sancho the Bailiff or Sancho the Steward, a Japanese period film, and Kenji Mitsuguchi, the director. He's dealing with, among other things, treatment of women in Japan at the time. This is the 1950s when it's made. Was he one of the first to take on that issue in that country then? And how unusual was that?
Well, Mitsuguchi is passionate about portraying not only women, but also poor people in his films. I wanted to show a film that had a great hero, a mythic hero. American films oftentimes have anti-heroes in them. So in order to find a real, as Joseph Campbell would say, based on these stories from mythology, I really had to go to other cultures to find a real prototype for this series. And I found it in Mizoguchi's Sancho the Bailiff. He is one of the great filmmakers in Japan. This film was one of his last. He had made dozens of films before he made this film. But the story of Zushio, who is the son of an aristocrat who is sold into slavery with his sister, just mark by mark follows the path of the mythic hero. And by the end of the film, I dare say almost anybody with any feeling who's seen the film has tears in their eyes. It is so moving. It is heroic in that Zushio, the character who is our hero in this story, that by the end he has really transformed himself into a person of the most excellent moral character. And it is a wonderful journey, difficult struggles, some hard times, but Zushio had to go so low that in the end he was able to save himself and transform himself into an amazing and wonderful character.
The struggle continues, but in a very dark place with the next selection in terms of Children of Men from 2006. And this is one I might just stop by to see because I was so unfamiliar with it. I know it came out fairly recently, but an unusual sci-fi vision for me. Usually it's overpopulation we're dealing with. Here it's the opposite.
Yes. Children of Men was directed by Alfonso Cuarón, who also directed Gravity. That was up for Best Picture last year. He's a very fine filmmaker. The art direction in this film is absolutely superb. This film is definitely not for young children. There is violence in it that is disturbing. The original story, the book was written by P.D. James, who just recently died, and it was a real different book compared to what she usually writes, the mysteries and whodunit sort of books. But this book is really a Christian fable. Cuarón does not like expository movies. He does not like a lot of exposition in his films. So the moviegoer really has got to figure out what's going on. He's not going to tell you. Our hero in the story is played by Clive Owen. And in the course of the film, yet again, he has to answer a call to adventure, a scary call, and then he ends up with many horrible things happening, but he prevails, and at the end, he again is transformed into a person who we admire, who has obtained real moral excellence. Cuarón uses newsreel-type camera work. So in watching the film, one really feels as if they're in the midst of the fight, and it is just a superb film. It's a film about hopelessness because, it's science fiction, and it's for two decades, a time when there was infertility in the world. And their hope had disappeared. There were no children anymore. And in the course of the film, hope shows up at the end. And after the I don't want to spoil it for people. If they have not seen it, they need to come and see it. It's a great story. But if I give too much detail, I might ruin it. But I will tell you this: it's a really fine film. It's worth coming to. I don't know why it wasn't nominated for Best Picture. It should have been.
The critics loved it, as I recall. But did it go over the heads of the audience?
I don't think it had big enough stars in it, although Michael Caine's in it. He's in a cameo role, and he gives a very fine performance in it. Julianne Moore, terrific actor, as is Clive Owen. But Clive Owen is not the big name that a lot of people pay attention to. And it's an English film. It was a joint production between Britain and the United States, but it just was not a blockbuster type movie. It's for a smart film goer. There are references to literature in it that would go over the heads of many people, and it's not the sort of film that would probably appeal to a 15-16-year-old boy, and that film goer is one of the prototypes that Hollywood targets. So more of an adult film. Again, there's violence that turns some people off. But again, I really encourage people to come see this film. It's one of my favorite films.
Centenary United Methodist Church Faith in Film Series Artistic Director Butter Berkus. This season, you can join Butter and fellow film fans of all ages throughout the series in their exploration of the mythic hero, except for Children of Men, which is decidedly not a kid-friendly film. The screenings are free and open to the public. They're every Sunday this month, beginning at 2 in Memorial Auditorium at Centenary, beginning Sunday, February 8th, with Charlie Chaplin's City Lights. You'll find more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. The Unbroken Circle is Wake Forest University's multi-generational string band. It's a community of musicians who gather together regularly to share in the fellowship of music making, song sharing, storytelling, and poetry reading. They also come together for worthy causes, and on Saturday night, February 7th at 7 o'clock, they'll offer a free concert at Kulinich Auditorium in the Byram Welcome Center on the Wake campus in Winston-Salem. Donations will be collected there for the Shalom Project, a Winston-Salem charity that feeds the hungry, provides clothes to those in need, and tutors at-risk children. They also care for the sick, running one of the largest free medical clinics in the city. The fundraiser will be an intimate evening of live, acoustic, old-time music and bluegrass with poetry readings by Ed Wilson. Wake Forest University Dean of Admissions Martha Allman is a member of the Unbroken Circle. She's a native of Mitchell County, North Carolina, in the Appalachian Mountains.
We decided to get together one night and just play and just had a magical evening. We had potluck dinner and played music together, and we found other friends. We found Wake Forest students who were also interested in Appalachian music, mountain music, bluegrass music, and they began showing interest. And so it grew into a group that meets once a month, and we have potluck dinner and play music, sometimes until very late in the night. And it's a fluid group. We have Wake Forest students, administrators, faculty. Students graduate and move on. New ones come in. Members of the group bring friends. And sometimes we have 40 people. Sometimes we have 15. It just varies from month to month.
Wow, that's a good group. And I put the cart ahead of the horse. Are you a fiddler? What's your instrument?
No, I play the auto harp. I'm the one probably with the least musical talent in the group. So it's left to me to organize the group. But I do play the auto harp. My youngest daughter is 16, and she plays every instrument. And so she is the youngest member of the band. We have had other small children who have come, 7-year-olds with their tiny little violins, and and some babies that have to be put to bed on the floor when we play at night, just like in the olden days. And then we have grandparents and Ed Wilson. So it's certainly multi-generational.
Wonderful. What's the best part of the Unbroken Circle for you?
It's absolutely the community and the sharing. This is the way people have entertained themselves for centuries, for generations, to sit around a circle and share songs and enjoy the music and teach each other music. You know, the younger people play Avett Brothers and Mumford and Sons, and, you know, some of us our age like the protest music of Woody Guthrie or John Prine, and we play that, and then we play the old-time fiddle tunes and the bluegrass, so it all kind of fits together. And over 8 years, we've become very close to each other, and we've lost members of the circle. We have grieved over those that graduate and move on, and again brought others in. But it's this common thread of interest in the music, interested in the heritage and the tradition of this music that's brought us all together. That's just really special.
Wake Forest University Dean of Admissions Martha Allman. The Wake alumna and auto harp player, along with her family, will join their friends in the Unbroken Circle on Saturday night, February 7th at 7 o'clock. They'll offer a free concert at Kulinich Auditorium and the Byram Welcome Center on the Wake campus in Winston-Salem. Donations will be collected for the Shalom Project, a nonprofit charity organization that tutors at-risk children and feeds, clothes, and cares for those in need. Ed Wilson will once again be reading poetry. The music will be rollicking good fun, and of course, it's all for a great cause. Last year, they had standing room only in the Welcome Center Auditorium and raised $8,000, and this year, with your help, they're hoping to repeat that success. Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And you'll find podcasts, archived episodes, and links to all of our guests and events and more on our website, wfdd.org. Just be sure and click on Triad Arts Weekend. And as always, if you have questions, comments, or suggestions, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email. That address is triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.